If you know anyone that has owned a home for over 30 years, I think you owe it to yourself to have a detailed conversation about that. And whether or not they attribute wherever they are, their successes or failures, to their home. And also take a different level of stock as to how nice the home actually is. And right. I don't mean to say that in an insulting way, but what I find is that so many of us are really just kind of blindly looking at home ownership as this award or reward or this indicator of success. And I think if you really look closely, like, just because someone's owned a home for 30 years and they're older now, and even just because they're happy, does not mean that their home was a smart investment for them. So you owe it to yourself to dig into the story, figure out whether or not those people still own or have a huge mortgage, whether or not they've had to refi several times and all of those things. Get the full story instead of just looking at their existing home, the size of it, maybe the yard or whatever it is that you seem to be attracted to. Yeah. Because I think a lot of us are making very, very emotional decisions.
Absolutely.
But aren't necessarily supplementing that with any degree of data or yes. reporting, because people don't necessarily talk about those things.
Yeah, and right? ask them if they would do what you're about to do.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. And today we're going to talk about some alternatives to buying a house right now.
I love it. I'm ready to jump on my soapbox. I can already tell there are going to be listeners who like flip this episode to a friend or family member that's like in the middle of like this crazy buyer's market. It's yeah. like, look, you do not.
Right.
Look, you need to consider all of these other options.
Right.
Or all of these other indicators. So.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a soapbox per se because I get the frustration.
Yeah.
I'm definitely the kind of person who wants things to happen with my whole self. Mm-hmm. And so more often than not, I do eventually get the thing, but I get the timing all wrong.
Yeah.
And so even still, after all these years, it's so disappointing when it happens.
Yeah.
And so I get it. Yeah. I think we've been watching the frenzy of the housing market from afar since last year.
Yeah.
And when it was picking up steam, we actually recorded an episode asking the question of if home ownership was a luxury.
Yeah.
And I think that was back in April of 2021.
It's yeah.
episode 4 for those that are keeping score at home. But the thing that prompted me to revisit the conversation today was this recent report from Zillow that showed that as of Q1 2022, the U.S. gained 146 new million-dollar cities.
Yeah.
Right. That means million-dollar city is not like an income level.
Right.
It's defined as cities where the typical home value is at least $1 million. It also revealed that there are more million-dollar cities this year than there were in the past 6 years combined.
Yeah.
And Idaho, Montana, and Tennessee, which are states that are well-known for being considered affordable, gain million-dollar city statushood for the first time
yeah.
ever.
Yeah, these are crazy times.
Right.
These are crazy, crazy times. Like, every time I get into a conversation about this housing market, like, we all just kind of, like, our eyes bug out. Like,
yeah.
I do not know what is happening right now. So, like, I'm not in it, so I didn't realize that things were this crazy to the point where we've seen such a huge uptick across the country of housing values. But
oh, yeah.
I won't say I'm surprised by that. If my social circle is any indication, because I have a couple of friends who are real estate agents and like mm-hmm. and they're doing well.
Yeah.
So they are and they are not shy about conveying how well they're doing. And so, like, one guy just bought a boat.
Yeah.
You know, another one is like pretty much wearing Gucci every time I see him.
Right.
And like the last one pretty much is like, if he's not at a closing, he's like celebrating a closing
mm-hmm.
that he just came from with like a giant margarita or something. Like, it's wild. We are not in the market. So we're not in the midst of this housing and home valuation craze. But it did prompt me to do some digging. And I only do this a couple times a year. And it might just be whenever we're recording an episode, just out of curiosity. And so I happened to look up our home value because I remember when we moved here in 2018, I believe. And I wanted to see how much more our home had increased in value. And from 2018, I think that was Q4 to Q1 2022, our home value is projected, and this is according to Zillow, 126, it's up $126,000.
Wow.
Which is crazy. It's up 25% in 3 years. But what's really interesting is you could probably get more for that, right? Like, that's just like what, you know, comp sales a couple of those things, like given the demand and the market.
Improved it.
Yeah, well, we really haven't. But I mean, it doesn't necessarily speak exactly to the type of craze that you could have. For example, I was talking to another friend of ours the other day, and he was saying that there was an open house in his neighborhood the other day. And only reason why he knew, because there was literally a line of people lined up outside, like, just trying to get into it. Yeah. So there's a lot of people, and we know we live in a desirable part of Atlanta. So I can only imagine what it would be like. But that I'm, you know, pushing us to consider, but it's wild times.
We do live in a desirable part of Atlanta, but we do not live in a $1 million house, just to be clear.
Right.
And Atlanta was not even listed in the top 10 metropolitan areas with the most $1 million homes.
Right.
For anyone who's curious, those cities were San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, San Jose, Boston, Seattle, Miami, DC, Santa Rosa, Santa Maria, Santa Barbara. I feel like I'm naming Columbus's ships. The Nina, the pizza.
Yeah, I was like, what about the Nina?
Santa Maria. Yeah, so if you're in a sand city, any of them? Oh, San Fran, San Jose?
I'm in Santlana. We're in Santlana.
Santlana.
Okay. All right. So that list is not surprising by any means. I mean, you know, when we think about large metropolitan areas, that comes at no surprise. And obviously it also is very much connected to where we're seeing job growth. But even outside of the top 10, we know that plenty of people are feeling the squeeze right now. So we wanted to spend some time talking about some of the alternatives to buying right now. So let's go ahead and dive in. I'm going to start. And this feels like a natural segue because we just recorded a podcast about investing. But I think one of the big alternatives to buying right now in this crazy buyer's market, or seller's market, I should say, is investing the money instead, right? So let's say you're looking to buy a home and you've been saving up thousands of dollars over the years. That money is sitting in cash in a savings account, which is what most people do. So let's just use an example. Let's say you have $40,000 saved up, and that's enough for a 10% down payment on a $400,000 home. I'm being generous here because we're assuming that you are a first-time home buyer. Maybe you're eligible for a program, but the reality is you may actually need to bring 15 or 20% down.
Way more.
But in this example, we're just going to try to keep it simple. You've got $40,000 saved up in cash sitting in a savings account. It might even be sitting in your checking account earning zero interest. There's still a pretty good chance that you're going to get outbid right now, right? Whether or not you qualify, you're pre-approved, all the good stuff. Like, there's this good chance you're still going to be outbid by someone who has like a cash offer or a real estate investor who has cash or is willing to put more down or is willing to just outbid you in some other way. Or it could be something like just a couple that has a job and they work for, you know, they just put together like a better package than you did. They've got, they work for, I'm just making it up, Delta and this other big law
and their
firm
company might
something.
Be absorbing a lot of the relocation fees.
Exactly.
Or even the home itself.
Whether or not your bid is accepted sometimes comes down to these tiny little details where someone feels more confident going with one particular offer because they think it lowers the risk of you likely defaulting or something or having some
or
type of issue or the closing money not coming through in time or something like that. It's about sending like a signal of confidence to a seller. What you could do if you're just over it, which I would totally be over it if this were me, is to just invest that money. But the next question you have to ask yourself is how? And I think one of the best things that you should do, especially since we just recorded a podcast about this, but you could do, let's say you were just done with home ownership altogether, go back to the previous episode and we give a very clear breakdown of what would have happened if you'd invested that money last year, let's say, into a total stock market index fund. And I don't want to sound like a broken record or a broken podcast, but That $40,000, if you had that in cash and invested it on January 1st, 2021, would be worth around 25% more. So basically $50,000 today. And so when you think about the contrast of earning little to nothing if it's sitting in cash compared to the possibility of earning $50,000 had you just decided to take another route, that is an option. You also have to factor in inflation. Last year, inflation was particularly high. And so when you think about the fact that that $40,000 is sitting in cash, your actual purchasing power, even if you were looking to purchase something other than a home, you really only have around $38,000 of purchasing power because of the impact of inflation last year. And 2022 was actually shaping up to look even a little worse. So it's definitely something that you should think about, you know, while you're searching right. for a home. And again, especially if you are over it, like, and that's something that only you as a listener would right. know. Like, what is over it? Look, are you tired of going?
You need to be truly
process?
Over it if you put it in the market.
Yeah.
It's not something you want to pull back out in, you know, 2 months when you get the itch again.
Exactly.
You want to let it sit long enough.
Exactly.
To Julian's point, to let it grow.
Yeah, yeah. But you definitely want to be mindful of the cost of setting this cash aside and basically not being able to do anything with it, because you are, if you're not doing anything with it, losing money.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because even if you're not investing in something like a total stock market fund, you should also be looking into funds that are designed to keep up with inflation.
Yes.
Typically when people think about investing, the default objective is to beat or to match the yes. market. But in this case, you can explore mutual funds that are just designed to keep up with inflation.
Yes.
So there's a really great article we found in Kiplinger that talks about this, and they go over 5 mutual funds that are designed to be hedges against inflation. They specifically mention VIPSX, which kind of sounds like I'm describing a dirty, like spelling out a dirty word.
It does.
But it's really just a boring
white color.
I know, VIPSX.
Sex club. Have you been?
Yeah. But it's really just a boring index fund that is crammed with bonds yeah. to help mitigate the risk. It's a Vanguard fund, and the minimum investment is $3,000, which shouldn't be a problem for anyone who's out there, depending on kind of where you choose to park your housing down payment. But more importantly, the expense ratio is 0.2%, which basically means that you'll pay about $20 for every $10,000 you invest.
Yeah.
So in this example, if you had $40,000, it would cost you $80 to hedge yourself from inflation. So basically, it's a matter of choosing to pay $80 to invest or lose, I think you mentioned, $2,000 to
no, it was like
inflation.
It's like $3,800, I think.
Well,
oh, no. Yeah, you're right. $40,000.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's up to you, listener, obviously, always. But, you know, personally, I would choose the $80. And I think I also like this option because it gets people into the habit of being more purposeful investors. I think, again, a lot of people only invest through an employer. But in this case, you'd have to open an account on your own, since you wouldn't be storing this down payment in an employer-sponsored plan that's mm-hmm. going to penalize you for pulling it out. This kind of puts you in the driver's seat in a really important decision. And it's just great practice for being intentional and using investing to solve different problems besides just retirement.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that. And I too will accept their $80 option as opposed to losing $2,000 just sitting there.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next example, it isn't so much of an alternative to buying a house, but it's more of an FYI, a little watch out, if you will, because so many people completely underestimate the cost of ownership to yeah. owning a home. And I think that's especially true for first-time home buyers. So we want to talk about that a little bit. So even when we bought like our home, and we're now, you know, this home is about twice as large in terms of square footage as the first one. There were several like costs that we were mindful of, but didn't really consider at the time of purchase. Like we knew we would have to buy these things over time, but it's not like we had set aside a budget for it.
Mm-hmm.
And like the first thing was like furniture and appliances, right? So you're moving into a place, you got more square footage, you know that you're eventually going to have to fill or furnish that room. Gosh, there were like appliances and things that you know you're going to need, but it's kind of difficult to imagine exactly how much it's going to cost you. You may find that your couch or like your table just doesn't fit mm-hmm. in your new space. And while it's still functional or while it still works, like after a while, it just kind of bites away at you. And, you know, you can try to ignore it for a while, but over time, like, you really are most likely going to want to replace that. So that's definitely something you want to think about, just like what would be the cost of, or the additional cost in terms of like furnishing and decor. I would say without question, just repairs and installation. Like, I get it. Everyone thinks that because they have a set of tools that they're going to be able to install and fix and like open up boxes and do some of these things on their own. Even if you don't, and you're going to be like us and you're calling in a task rabbit, you've got to build that into your funds. Those don't always cost the same thing every single time. So right. You want to factor in how much is it going to cost to have all those light fixtures replaced, or ceiling fans replaced, or curtain rods, or, you know, custom blinds, or, and all that stuff. Like, you may not necessarily know or be able to predict that. I'll also say tools. If you're going to do it yourself, you might need to buy tools in order to actually install some of those things yourself. And obviously there's time. Something else I think, especially first-time homeowners don't think about, because all they see is storage. Like, we're always happy when we see more storage than what we've had, right. But we don't think about the fact that, well, it actually costs money to buy storage solutions for the storage space.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You need
a garage system. Like, all the boxes and bags and hooks. What are you going to do with shelves.
That? Yeah, yeah. And again, you may tell yourself, oh, it's not that expensive. But then you realize, yeah, well, with all this space, well, you need 10 of them, right? Yep. So there's all of that stuff. And then the last thing, I think, is really around, like, professional services, like lawn care, your gutters, pest control. Like, if you're rolling your eyes and you've heard this before, there's a reason why I'm saying it, is because people continue. It doesn't show up on your HUD statement.
Yes.
You're not breaking it down. And people just kind of say, cost of ownership is expensive. I'm telling you, it is really, really expensive. And especially with the services, because they tend to go up over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is the alternative to buying a house is to just keep saving. You know, maybe it goes towards a bigger down payment so you can get more favorable terms on your mortgage, since the Fed just announced that interest rates are going up. Mm-hmm. This is especially true for first-time buyers, which, according to a survey, they make up about 34% of home buyers compared to 31% a couple years ago.
Wow.
But first-time home buyers tend to have lower credit scores than repeat buyers. So there's the double whammy regarding the terms of the mortgage and the interest rate that you're going to be paying. But on top of all of that, going back to your point, there's a growing trend because of the competitive of the market that realtors are telling their clients to waive home inspections in order to close sooner. So between labor shortages and inflation driving up the cost of goods, that can get really, really expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of the things that you named are about 30% higher now. And so if this is you, if this sounds like you, take a look at your anticipated budget for the total cost of home ownership, not just your mortgage, but I mean mortgage, insurance, repairs, and imagine it being 30% higher than you expected.
Minimum.
So yes, I get that that's moving the goalpost, but it's important to stay honest about the nature of your purchase so that you don't get yourself into a situation where you're house poor and you don't have enough money to actually maintain the house, which is critical to it maintaining its value.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I will also say, if you're the type of person like us that felt like, oh, well, that's not necessarily relevant because we're buying new.
Right.
You hear that? Oh, no, we're buying new.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. You're buying new at a time where builders are
rushing to get this thing done. And I can tell you from personal experience, when we bought our home new, we thought we wouldn't have any issues. But I would say for a couple of months over the first 2 years, we had two different situations where we had holes in our ceilings. One was because it was a leak from the roof that was creating a leak. And then there was another one that was a leak from the bathtub upstairs that created a leak. And so two different times there were leaks coming in. And so again, brand new home, but it doesn't mean that there won't be mistakes. So yeah, owning a home is expensive, guys.
Right.
All right. So I want to transition because our friend Athena Valentine, she gives some really interesting advice. She actually has, it's almost like a Dear Susie or a Dear Doctor, like one of those
advice columns
for Slate. But this is like a financial advice Slate column. And someone wrote in and she responded, but here was the situation. It was a couple who wrote in saying that they had fudged a little bit on their loan application. They qualified for a home mortgage and now they were like in trouble. So long story short, they sold their condo at a loss. They took the proceeds combined with like the cash that they had saving up and they purchased a new home. They cleared underwriting for a mortgage. They did all the things right, but their budget was based on the assumption that a family member who committed to offering financial assistance, I think it was for a child or something.
For their child's tuition.
Yeah. A family member said that they would be covering tuition for their son's tuition until they graduated. But 10 months into the situation, they basically flaked. They never came through.
Yeah, the money never came.
They just never came, they, you know, for whatever reason.
So they bought this house assuming that someone would be covering part of their child's tuition.
Right, which they built into their budget to qualify for this mortgage. And then the money never came. And so they had to come out of pocket to cover those things, which made it that much more difficult for them to actually own the home. And so now, you know, obviously their relationship is at a point where they're submitting letters like, help, what should we do?
Yeah.
And so one person in the relationship thinks that they should sell. Like, let's just get out of this situation while we can and move into a smaller house. The other person thinks that they should like go super lean, trim all the fat, like no travel, no luxuries, no nothing, and basically like try to ride this thing out and sell later. So what Athena does is she gives them a heaping dose of truth and brings up the elephant in the room, which is that they may be missing like the real lesson here, which is that they shouldn't have bought the home in the first place. And now they want to rush into buying another one without a plan to pay for upkeep or like, you know, the pricey mortgage and taxes and all of the things that we spoke about before. And so she asked them to really consider whether property ownership is right for them at this time.
Right.
Because renting might actually be much more manageable for them and give them an opportunity to like rebuild their emergency fund and accomplish a few other financial to-dos.
Yeah, I love her advice because I think that a lot of people struggle with letting go of ideals, even when there isn't evidence to support them. And that's ripe, fertile soil for buyer's remorse, which, according to another Forbes article, is a thing. 80% of millennials who recently bought a home have at least one significant regret about the home buying process or the house itself. So it could be an inconvenient location, a bad fit for the neighborhood. Maybe you're not a dog person, but your neighborhood is a dog person neighborhood.
Right.
Home values have actually decreased where they bought, or they just ended up with a fixer upper. And going back to your point about tools, supplies, even labor, it's hard to get anything done. There were two things that really stuck out to me from the survey results. The first was that the survey found that the most significant cause behind the regret was that millennials felt rushed into making big decisions because of the competitive market. 42%, almost half of millennials, were prepared to make snap decisions about buying a home. This is stuff like buying it sight unseen, making full offers after one walkthrough, waiving appraisals, all that stuff, versus only 24% of baby boomers that were willing to do that. And I think this goes back to some of the things we talked about in our episode on financial wisdom a few weeks ago, where with time you start to learn what risks are worth taking and which ones aren't.
Yep.
But the second thing was that the study indicated that nearly one third of millennials intended to live in their home for less than 5 years. And the hope was that the property value would continue appreciating and prices would just keep rising. But going back to what we were just talking about, yes, homes are appreciating at a much faster rate than they were pre-pandemic. But unless you live in an area that has outsized demand, like some cities that Zillow listed, making your home more valuable usually requires a lot of work, which requires some money. So if you're not willing to do that, it's not like it just magically increases in value just because you've lived in it for 5 years. You have to live in an area that as a whole is going up at that rate.
Yeah, yeah. I am not surprised that number is as high as it is. Like, none of those numbers really, but like especially the 80% of millennials who are expressing one significant regret, because we talk to them all the time, right? And so again, I feel like I want to make a disclaimer, like, we're not trying to dissuade you.
We're not trying to dissuade you.
But I am.
I'm trying to make sure you understand.
Yeah. Like, listen, like, it's not all it's, you know, cracked up to be. So, you know, there's that. I'll also say I understand the pressure because I've been there. I remember buying my first home. I moved out of my mom's home and went straight into buying a home at 28. And I was a grad student at the time, and I was working at the school part-time, and I was working at restaurants to pay the bills, like school plus two jobs. Like, it was a lot. But I think my mom at the time was caught up in the mortgage craze. She was a mortgage consultant. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she had a very biased point of view on how smart of a decision it is. It was almost like a, like, you can't go wrong, right? Like, it always goes up, to your point about the regrets that people have, even if they only plan on living there for 5 years. Like, you really have to think about buying a home very similar to, like, getting married.
Right.
You know, you're making a long-term decision. You're taking out a long-term note. And so if your plan is to leave in under 5 years, then you probably should just go ahead and rent. And yes, it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but you will not have to worry about any of the other things that we've seen a lot of people have to deal with. So.
Right. All right. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with some other things that you can do besides buying a house right now. Okay, so far we've talked about parking your savings somewhere that hedges against inflation, whether it's a total stock market fund or just a fund that's specifically created to hedge against inflation. We've talked about continuing to save to cover the rising costs of home ownership. And we've also offered a couple of cautionary tales around buyer's remorse and getting a little too much mortgage. The next alternative is a bit of a wild card, but that is to change the scene and go live in somebody else's house for a while. Maybe a month, maybe three. And I know people are on the other end of this, Kirsten, that doesn't make any sense. And I get it. Admittedly, it's a reach. But hear me out, because this cannot be nearly as crazy as being willing to pay 30 to 40% above asking prices, right, waiving apparel, appraisals, and inspections on homes. Like, I can't be crazy compared to what the market is asking you to do.
Right. So I'm crazy.
Right.
Got it.
So hear me out. I think home sharing has been around, you know, darn near forever. Even before Airbnb, this was an option. But over the past few months, Airbnb has introduced a number of features that are actually pushing the platform towards more monthly and long-term stays. Over 80% of hosts now accept longer-term stays. And contrary to popular belief, living out of an Airbnb full-time can actually work out to be cheaper than renting. So if you're not into Airbnb, Sonder is another company that specializes in this. And what's interesting is that the Points guy actually did a whole breakdown on this, which I'll link to in the show notes. But it comes with a level of flexibility that really isn't available through other housing options, because you're not signing a year-long lease, right, and you can move back home whenever you want. And if you happen to be worried about how you're going to pay for living in two places at one time, you can consider putting your house up too, right? So it's a full house swap situation. You allow somebody else to live in your house for a month or three or six or whatever it is, and then you go try out someone else's house and test those features that you really value. Is it super important that you have a view? Is it really important that you're within walking distance of a Starbucks? Go see. Because what might happen is that you start to change your requirements for the home that you're looking for,
yep,
and can find more affordable neighborhoods or options for you and your family.
I am all for this, especially for people who don't have children, like young professionals maybe, or even just like small families. And as you were talking, it reminded me that my mom actually did this for a while. Like, again, she was willing to get scrappy, right, to her credit, to make some things happen. And obviously her dream was to someday own a home. But if I'm not mistaken, this is what we did before we actually were able to buy that home. And so we basically lived in a townhome with a professional who I presume must have traveled a lot because she was never home. And it was one of those cases where she owned a home. I'm never there. You guys can basically help cover the rent.
Right.
As long as you're going to be respectful, which, you know, they were. And I'm pretty sure they were like coworkers or something like that.
Yeah.
And they figured it out. And I think we did that for maybe a little under a year. Mm-hmm. My mom used that to expedite building up her down payment, and we eventually moved out and then purchased our home. And so you don't have to do it forever,
right.
But I think it's certainly a creative way to solve a problem, and it's certainly less expensive than renting, right?
Yeah.
Or even having to, like,
because it's only one payment, right?
Correct.
You're only paying the monthly fee. The
correct.
Utilities still go to the homeowner. If you use your credit card, you can earn points on that. There's a lot of benefits to doing it this way that
yep.
don't exist in renting.
Yep, yep. And I also think that even beyond single family homes, like, this is something that I think we're going to slowly see a little bit more of. But what's interesting is, like, if you think about mainstream media, they present this to you as if it's normal.
Right.
Right?
Well, it is in a lot of different places.
I don't know that it is to the extent that they pressure you, or that they want to make you believe on television, right? You watch New Girl or Friends
yeah.
or
yeah.
Living Single or whatever your show is. They literally show you people living with roommates all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk to people, like, would you ever consider thinking of roommates?
Like,
no.
It's like, no.
It's crazy talk. I'd
and
never
like,
do that.
There's plenty of adults that have roommates.
It happens all the time.
It's literally normal.
Yeah. And it's, again, like, I think it's one of those really, really cool, creative ways. And so you're going to see a lot more of this, I think, in loft spaces, a lot of those office buildings that, you know, these businesses aren't coming back. You're going to start seeing a lot more of these kinds of things. This is my little prediction. But I know the first time I read about this, so I should say in recent years, it was a full article, and maybe I'll find it and put it in the show notes, but it was an article on Vice, and they were talking about people teaming up and doing this in Toronto, which, again, another very high cost of living space. And so that tends to be the incident or the precursor to why people say, you know what, I want to own a home, but it's going to require me to get creative. And they end up buying the home of their dreams, because four of us can get the big house,
exactly.
you know, in the expensive part of town, but I can't carry it just on my paycheck. So why not find three of my friends that are doing well, by the way, but are willing to just get creative and make it happen.
Yes, that's the perfect segue to this last alternative, which is to explore other types of living arrangements. Similar to, you know, living in somebody else's house, this option is in the spirit of the new normal requiring a new approach. And the idea that one family needs to own the house and the land may
right.
just be a little bit outdated. So there's prefab and container homes, which are just two types of construction that has proven to be durable and cost efficient despite their lack of popularity. But there's also communal living or housing cooperatives that are gaining popularity.
Exactly.
So with co-ops, the setup varies, but generally you buy shares that give you partial ownership of a housing company that owns or leases real estate. So for example, in Atlanta, there's Ansley North Co-op, and you can buy into the co-op with around $10,000 cash. And then the total home or share cost is $110,000 for a 2-bedroom. So instead of having a mortgage, you work to pay off the shares and your portion of the operating expenses to the housing company that owns it. I'll leave a link to other U.S. co-ops in the show notes. But another option is community land trusts. So community land trusts are nonprofit entities that take land and housing out of this very speculative market and allows it to be held, quote unquote, in trust. And they offer long-term leases that are sort of removed from, again, all of the volatility caused by buyer panic.
Hmm.
The benefit is that they keep housing affordable in the long term, and it allows you to gain equity as you're paying into the trust.
Yeah. What I love about those is that they all, for the most part, include an element of living small
yeah.
and the importance of living small and the impact that that has on your ability to save and, as a result, redirect income to other things that are income generating or like investing. But I love that, right? Because like living small kind of forces you to think twice before you buy another thing and bring it into your space.
Exactly.
I've also found that this is very much a regional thing. So there's certain
yeah.
people who, in certain parts of the country, who are far more open to that. It's really interesting. Like here in the South, it's not that big, I think. It's
right.
just, we're just culturally accustomed to having our home,
having
big
land.
Old home.
Yeah.
Like we take pride in that. Whereas
yeah.
in New York, like you're not accustomed to that. So it's like, I don't need all that space. You can't even wrap your head around what you would do
right.
with 3x more space. But that's only because you're thinking about how much more it would cost
right.
if you had that in New York. But I really like that. And when I think about, you know, I would say the period of our life where we were the most minimalist or our savings rate was at its peak was in large part because we decided to live small. Mm-hmm. We lived in, I think it was like 1,400 square feet or something like mm-hmm. that. And our peak, our savings rate was like 70%. Like
right.
We were able to do that largely in part. We didn't have a child for two of those years or three of those years. But we were able to get ahead largely because we decided to live small. And the last thing I'll say about living small is that it also reminds you of how much of the world outside of your front door you haven't seen, or like why those places exist, right? Because I think so much of us feel like, oh, I want to have a home, and it's got to have a gym, and it's got to have a sunroom, and it's got to have a patio, and it's got to have my reading area. And I'm like, well, you know, when you live small, you're reminded that there are gyms, like really nice gyms.
Yeah.
And it was like, there are several libraries, and this is what restaurants are for.
Yeah.
And you can go to the park anytime you want. And like office buildings are there because you don't have to work from home, as convenient as that is. And
absolutely.
So living small just kind of forces you to say, all right, there's a world out here that you can go to and take as much advantage of. You don't have to try to make the world sort of fit inside
your
residence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm always reminded that my preference for space is a very American and Western ideal.
And Southern.
And it's mostly driven by other ideologies, like my stuff, how much stuff you have, and my individualism, as if I don't know how to share utilities and buildings and tables. Whenever we visit other countries or even other regions in the United States, like you mentioned, I'm reminded of the creativity that people have with small spaces, and perhaps even more importantly, the freedom to just get up and go and move.
Yeah.
I remember when we first found the tiny house movement and we were so intrigued by it. And even lately, I'm still intrigued by how many people have opted into this RV van life.
Yes.
And like there's tons of blogs that show how they get by. And it's kind of interesting. Like, I don't know that I'm going to sign up for it now at this stage in my life, but it's like I'm no longer willing to completely write it off.
Yeah, I could see it as something that you do just for an experience.
Yeah.
Right. So if we're going to take a month long vacation out west or something like that, I could see a world where we decide to spend a couple of days in a tiny house or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, you're just sleeping there.
Right.
You know, you're not spending
the day out.
Yeah. You're going to be outside. You're going to be wherever you want to be. But, you know, I'll try it at some point. If any of our listeners have tried it, send us a note. Let us know what we should do.
All right. Let's hop to final thoughts. I'll go first. So my final thought is actually some homework. I want you to go back and look at the stories of your financial role models. And I'll bet you 9 times out of 10, you're going to see a recurring through line about how they've managed their housing costs. Very few of them are going to talk about being willing to overpay in seller's markets or waive appraisals or take out mortgages that are more than what they can afford based on a faulty assumption. Everyone is going to talk about how managing your housing costs is one of the easiest ways to achieve your financial goals. So I want you to go do that and then go back and revisit your decision and see if there's something else that you can do to scratch the itch if buying a home right now is going to set you back in your financial plans.
I love that, because you're actually making me rethink my final thought. I had one, but I think I'm going to pivot and speak off the cuff here. So my final thought, 1A, is I think you owe it to yourself to have a detailed conversation with the people who have owned homes for over 30 years.
Mm.
If you know anyone that has owned a home for over 30 years, I think you owe it to yourself to have a detailed conversation about that. And whether or not they attribute wherever they are, their successes or failures, to their home. And also take a different level of stock as to how nice the home actually is. And
right.
I don't mean to say that in an insulting way, but what I find is that so many of us are really just kind of blindly looking at home ownership as this award or reward or this indicator of success. And I think if you really look closely, like, just because someone's owned a home for 30 years and they're older now, and even just because they're happy, does not mean that their home was a smart investment for them. So you owe it to yourself to dig into the story, figure out whether or not those people still own or have a huge mortgage, whether or not they've had to refi several times and all of those things. Get the full story instead of just looking at their existing home, the size of it, maybe the yard or whatever it is that you seem to be attracted to.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of us are making very, very emotional decisions,
absolutely,
but aren't necessarily supplementing that with any degree of data or reporting, because people don't necessarily talk about those things.
Yeah, and ask them if they would do what you're about to do.
Exactly.
Right? Ask if you were me, would you do this thing and see what they say?
And they will say no, because housing did not cost nearly as much.
Right.
It was not nearly that much of a percentage of my income as it is with you guys. So good luck.
Right.
But you're not living here.
Well, on that note, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. I'd like to offer you one last alternative to buying a house, and this one costs you nothing, but also does not solve anything near your housing challenge. Well, but at least it makes me smile. Leave us a 5-star rating and review on the Apple Podcast ratings and review page or wherever you listen to the podcast. As always, we appreciate your support, and we will see you next week.